Welcome to our show. My name is Six Flop, and you're listening to episode number 4 of the Uber Elite Hacker Force radio program. This is kind of a special episode because I'm doing it more or less live. I mean, you're listening to it, kind of post-production, right? But there is no real production. There is no editing. It's, I kind of don't like editing, especially when it comes to radio programs. So, on OpenBSD, typically what's used for sound is a library called libsound.io. And what libsound.io does, aside from dumping sound directly to a device, it also can dump sound to a socket. And this socket is being listened to by a user space program called AUCAT. And AUCAT mixes the streams that comes into the socket and dumps them to the sound device, or does the reverse way around if you have a full duplex sound device at the same time, which is very nice. So this radio program is kind of like a speaker cast. The music you are hearing is being played in M Player, and I'm talking on a radio receiver. So there you go. This episode we're going to be talking to Cobra 2, and we are also going to be talking to the Command Line of the Command Line podcast, and we're going to be releasing a couple of things. But before any of this, our standard poem. This one is called Ode to My Computer. And if you have any poem that you'd like, send it in, so I don't have to write a poem every episode, but this is our standard poem. When I think of the sheer amount of work needed to put together a modern poem/essay, alright, when I think of the sheer amount of work needed to put together a modern operating system, it makes me never bored by my computer. My fingertips rest on a machine containing years and years, combined lifetimes, of hard work. When I think of all the work and its source code on my hard drive and the fact that I have complete access to it, I'm just amazed. Many times I've spent my day saying things to myself like, I wonder how malloc works, and actually being able to find out. As I look over the code line by line, it kind of reminds me of stones in an Egyptian pyramid or something. I imagine the sweat that's gone into each one. I imagine the debugging nightmare to get it actually working. It's pretty awesome when you think about it. Great engineering efforts have always fascinated me. thinking about the sums of people's work, I've always found very exciting. Now, the first thing we're going to release is a program called Yes Please. What Yes Please is a command line program that takes a screenshot of your computer and uploads it to a screenshot aggregator called UnixPorn.com. Now, to explain what that is, I'm going to be talking with Cobra 2, the maintainer of UnixPorn.com, briefly here. I recorded this interview about a week ago, doing my same sort of hack to AUCAT to dump out to a WAV file. And the receiver I was using at the time was a payphone receiver, and it sounded absolutely horrible. It sounded way pinched. So, you know, I wonder how much the sound quality is degraded in payphones simply because of the receiver. But anyway, I blame it perhaps on the impedance of the microphone to the receiver versus what kind of microphone my computer wanted or something like that. It just sounded terrible. But when I talked to Cobra 2, it came out pretty well. So let me play that.
So let's stop the music there. Kind of feel like this is the phone show or something with the music stopping like that. And give Cobra a call. I believe this is his phone number. See if we don't wake him up. Pick up the phone, Cobra.
Hello?
Hey, is this Cobra 2?
Yes, it is. Hang on a second. Let me walk away from the party.
All right.
I did manage to get here safely and securely.
So?
That was really nice.
What kind of party at?
I am at a middle-of-nowhere party. Basically, a bunch of guys and girls get together and drive out on pretty much an abandoned logging road. You drag in a DJ with full equipment, a bunch of beer and alcohol, and just party until the morning.
Hmm. Well, that actually sounds like a lot of fun, to be honest with you. I'm saying that sounds like a lot of fun, to be honest with you.
I think I'm going to have a lot of fun.
So, Cobra, I've
been
meaning...
I'm not going to get drunk, but...
I've been meaning to ask, why Cobra 2? Why not just Cobra?
Well, Cobra 2 is the first password I ever came up with. And when it came time for me to play around with IRC, I wanted the nickname Cobra, but somebody else already had it, so I was like, yeah, Cobra 2.
I see. Kind of stuck. So, what's this UnixPorn.com stuff that everyone's talking about?
UnixPorn is basically a place where Linux geeks and nerds and pretty much anyone that uses a Nix desktop goes to post their screenshots of their just average, everyday Unix/Linux setup. And I say Unix/Linux because there's screenshots of Solaris, various BSDs, and Linux environments posted up there. It's basically, you know, it's kind of a niche community of where people can just go to kill a little bit of time and see everything that's out there and see how every individual user customizes the desktop to their own personal preference and just basically explores the flexibility of open source.
Yeah, it's kind of fun, to be honest with you. At least I think it is to see what other people are up to. Now you're the maintainer of this site, I take it. How long has it been around? Because I've been I was made aware of it through, I think, Tit Radio, actually, to be honest with you. But how long has this been around?
Well, Clatu started up Unix Porn back in the I'm going to say roughly the third and fourth quarter of 2008. And I got on board at the end of 2008, somewhere around December, and just kind of got involved and asked if Clatu needed any help. And because we were getting a lot of spam attacks on Unix Porn. I mean, we were having hundreds of thousands of spam comments posted on everyone's post every day, and they weren't getting deleted. And I asked Clatu if he needed some help getting rid of that, and he just made me an admin, and I've stuck with it ever since.
So, you're still deleting a lot of spam, I take it.
Not so much. I changed some configurations and mucked around with a couple of settings and drastically reduced the amount of spam that we had. But unfortunately, that cut out the ability of anonymous comments. Like, just anyone visiting the website couldn't just go, "Hey, I really like this setup. Can you send me your config files? You know, send me an email here." That sort of thing. Which was really kind of a bummer, because not everybody wants to go through the hassle of registering an account with yet another website.
Yeah, but,
In the end, it
seems like
out.
The best solution.
Oh,
No. Yeah, I was just saying it seems like the best solution, but you go ahead and say what you're going to say.
Yeah, in the end, it works out fairly well. Now we have hardly any spam. The only spam that we do have are from those really, really nice people who actually go through the entire registration process, and not just a bot.
So the persistent spammers, in other words. No. I'm kidding. It's been pretty good. I haven't even, I wasn't even aware that there was any spam at all. I have not been exposed to it on Unix Porn, to be honest with you. So, guys are doing a good job at keeping out spammers.
I'm kind of on top of the user registration and the kind of spam that pops up anytime a new user is registered to the website. I get a lovely email that says, "Hey, someone's registered to the website," and I'll give them about 30 minutes, and then I'll go run behind and check and make sure they're not an actual spammer. If they are, I take care of it.
All right, cool beans.
Now I've got the wonderful ability to SSH into my machine from anywhere. So I can just take care of it.
All right, well, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for letting us know what Unix Porn is.
Anytime.
And I hope you enjoy the party.
Thank you very much. I'll do my best.
Yeah, don't do anything I wouldn't do. I don't know what that means. So.
I'm going to be a good boy. I'm getting married very soon.
Oh, really?
So, I need to keep... Yes, ma'am.
Wow, cool beans. When are you getting married?
June 19th, 2010.
Oh, my goodness. So that's coming right up. That's real soon.
Yes, it is. I'm looking forward to it.
Cool beans. Congratulations.
Thank you.
All right, you take care, Cobra 2.
Pardon?
Oh, you take care, Cobra 2.
You too, Miss Sig. Well, don't have too much fun tonight.
Oh, I'll definitely not. So, all right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So this program, again, is a command line program called Yes Please. Spelled WESPLZ. You can download this at the Uber Elite Hacker Force main site, which is in the show notes, of course. And, well, I might as well tell you what it is, too, in case you don't get this in the show notes. It's Uber Elite Hacker Force, all one word, deepgeek.us. And again, what this is a command line program. You type it in, and you specify arguments, title, album name, any tags that you want, anything like that, delay before taking a screenshot, or anything of that nature. It also reads a configuration file for commonly used arguments, for username and whatnot. And then it uploads it to UnixPorn. It's fairly straightforward. And if you have any problems with it, feel free to email me. And if you can't get it working on your system for whatever reason, I will do my best to get it working on your system, even if that involves you setting up an account and me secure shelling into your system to get it to work, which is kind of fun. I did that on Cobra's system. It's a pretty underutilized aspect of a lot of Linux distributions, or Unix distributions generally, is you know, you have multi-users, and you have user accounts, but no one ever really uses more than two users, it seems. Root, and then their unprivileged user. Now, the second release is a, well, this is a pre-release, actually. It's not software, it's actually a bit of hardware. It's a little device with six buttons. You plug in your computer through your USB port. It looks like a USB keyboard to your computer. And what this device does is it generates, stores, and types your passwords for you, in addition to usernames. It's kind of a quick interface. It's sort of a corded sort of interface where you don't need to traverse any sort of menu or anything like that to use it. So you can just hold down some buttons and it'll type out a username, or hold down some other buttons and it'll type out a password. Now the manual to this you can find at the Uberlead Hackforce main site. You can also find a video of the prototype. This isn't something that I will be producing probably for another couple of months. I have to order a couple of controllers and start making art for the manufactured board, and then start to manufacture them. But if you want to pre-order and help me out, you certainly may. There's also a pre-order form there. And hopefully this Passy Pass will be in your hands. And maybe you can attach it to your keychain or something like that. And tell me all about it and any suggestions that you have or anything like that. The random number generator inside of it is a pseudo-random number generator that itself isn't terribly complex or probably cryptographically secure. It's a pretty good pseudo-random number generator, I suppose, for passwords. The thing, though, is it's seeded by, it has a little fault to it from the seed, from timing delays between key presses. It's probably not too susceptible to birthday attacks, given that, but then I'm no cryptanalyst, so I can't attest to the actual strength of the algorithm, but you'll probably have no problems with it. We can always replace the algorithm if you want. Your passwords are stored in electronically erasable programmable read-only memory on the chip. That's EEPROM. And well, I hope to get this little device out there, because it's something that I need, and it's probably something that you need too. Now, the next thing we're going to do on this episode of Uberlead Hackforce Radio is talk to our friend Command Line. This is a pre-recorded interview of sorts. It's not really an interview. You probably know a lot about him just from his podcast, so I thought there wasn't a real need for me to interview him or anything like that. It's more of a discussion on parallel computers, multi-threaded operating systems and computers as well, programming models, and whatnot. And quite the knowledgeable guy. It's kind of interesting talking to him. Like, I would say a couple things and then he would go on for a while. Then I'd say a couple of things and he'd go on for a while. It's very an easy interview. More or less. That's not to belittle either of us by any means, of course. But before we get into that interview, I'm going to play a bit of music for a musical break. And I won't be returning So thank you for listening to this episode, and I will see you next time.
Hey, command line, how's it going?
Good.
How many, the computer you have right now, the computer that you would consider maybe your best computer, how many cores does this have?
It has 8.
It has 8. When did you first buy a multi-core machine? When did you first think of this? When did you realize that, did you have, was it exciting for you to realize that it's become common for processors to have multi-cores, or when did you first do anything with parallel computers, more generally?
It's always fascinated me. I remember when I was younger, fresh out of college, falling in with a bunch of network engineers at my first job that were really into scratch building their own PCs. And that seemed at that time was kind of like the holy grail to get like I want to say it was the Tyan Tomcat motherboard that had 2 sockets and could do, you know, in a standard footprint, could do SMP, could drop 2 CPUs in it. So it was always kind of the, you know, if I could get enough cash together, if I could find, you know, an operating system that would support it or, you know, the right drivers or whatnot. I really wanted to do that. It just seemed to make sense to me at that time that
you know, if the OS could saturate one processor, that would leave another free to do whatever. You know, at that time it was probably like Quake 2, Quake 3, you know, really, really kind of graphic intensive gaming. I had around that same time, I also remember playing around with not multi-core on the main bus, but with the SLI 3D graphics, like the old monster cards that you could actually pair together. And I had a pair of those, and some people had higher-end graphics cards when we were doing LAN parties. But I remember being very proud of the fact that because I had two of those cross-connected, and so each essentially was rendering every other pixel line in each frame of the game we were playing, that I was actually getting much better frame rates and a much smoother gaming experience. And then, you know, I kind of, as life goes, things got busier, the jobs got more demanding, started family, kind of fell out of building my own systems. So I think it was when the first SMP PowerPC G5s, the first Macs that had multiple processors in them, that started looking very attractive for very much the same reasons. And you know, it doesn't hurt. You know, I will admit to at least being partially a Mac fanboy. I have increasingly more cause for criticism, but there's still a little bit of softness in my heart towards their industrial design and some of their decisions. But that line of processors, so I still have the Power Mac G5. That was my studio rig up until about a year and a half ago. And then that got replaced with the 8-core, which is a Mac Pro. So it's the two quad-core processors. So it's multi-core and SMP. So it's kind of the best of both. So, yeah, it's definitely something that gets me excited in terms of, especially as I've gotten more into audio, realizing the benefit of being able to, again, do a lot more, have a lot more processing power to bounce down audio, but still be able to pursue other tasks. So I put out, for my podcast, I'm putting out multiple formats. So having that many cores means that I can be mixing down audio and I can be transcoding at the same time. And it runs as smooth as if I'm just doing one or the other. There's no difference if I'm running them at the same time. And that's really appealing for saving time, you know, because I want to focus much more in that instance where I'm taking full advantage of having all of that parallel power. I want to take advantage of that by maximizing the time I'm spending writing up an episode or doing the work that's not as easy automating and taking out all of the things and all of that nonsense.
I've had single core machines for quite some time. In fact, I still do have single core machines. So it's kind of an exotic sort of treat to be on any sort of system with multi-cores. And my first experience of this was kind of similar to yours, I suppose. I had a couple of Voodoo 2 cards, which you could hook up together. And it seemed like a fairly straightforward task to render every other scan line or have some sort of easy sort of division of computation for these two cards. I don't know, like I haven't really experienced doing any audio editing or anything like that with a multi-core machine. You say that this is fairly transparent. Out of curiosity, what operating system are you running this on when you do your audio stuff?
For doing audio production work, I'm running OS X on the Mac Pro. I have also had this same system configured for a Linux, because for the day job I do some fairly heavy lifting web development. And in that instance, I also find, in both operating systems, I actually find the experience very seamless. I do more of the lower level platform work for the applications at the day job, which means that we deploy in a clustered environment. So this is, again, kind of another variation on parallel processing, but it spreads that parallelism across multiple actual servers. To get more scalability in servicing requests, because we also want to replicate the networking hardware. We don't want to be bounded necessarily by a shared memory bus, that kind of thing. And having the ability also in a clustered environment, something you can't do with a multi-core system or an SMP system, is you can't crack the box while it's running and add additional processors in. Whereas a cluster, while it's not directly comparable, except maybe conceptually, you can just spin up a new node in the cluster and get more throughput that way, more processing power that way. So to do development work and make sure that some of the things that I'm doing that actually are affected by being deployed in that sort of an environment behind a load balancer where requests might get ping-ponged back and forth and there's sharing in the database and that there's other means of sharing calls and information between nodes in the cluster. I do a lot of virtualization, and that I do all on Linux, and that's also fairly seamless. Right now I'm using VirtualBox, which is, I guess Oracle owns it now. Sun picked it up a while ago, which is just a desktop system for virtualization, but I've been looking at Xen or KVM with some serious interest because it would seem to me that that tying in more closely to the timing loop of the host OS, the event loop, the timing loop, that would be even more efficient. And again, like with the audio production work, there's nothing you need to do special to take advantage of that. There might be some tweaking you can do to peg, you know, a particular hypervisor to a particular CPU. But so far, I haven't found the need for that. The OSs that are multi-core aware, so an SMP capable Linux kernel or OS X being coupled very closely with the hardware design just seems to make that, as you say, very transparent, very easy to just run the apps that I want to run and know that I'm getting the full horsepower out of the hardware that I'm using.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we have sort of in processing power. There's no Moore's Law is dead, and it's not probably a very natural thing for us to expect any sort of exponential scale with anything. But what strikes me as unusual is putting multi-cores on a single die. Now, do you know, out of curiosity, do you know if this is using the same memory bus, or is it using maybe multiple buses connected to some sort of memory controller? And are these memories redundant in any way? Do you have like a couple of pairs where we have two bits per bit, or something like that? It seems like we're not working around the bottleneck of memory, and processor speeds has increased so much, but memory essentially has stayed the same, and it strikes me as weird that it doesn't seem like we're working around this. Do you know if we are working around this?
I think your characterization on the same die, I think that's correct. There may be some division on the memory bus, but I think by and large that's still very much a limiter than on a 4-core or even an 8-core die that it's...
They have their own cache line, right? So there's some separation there, but...
But from there on out, I think you're right. I think you're running the risk of running into contention, but I do know that the when you get past that, so like the Mac Pro, it's at that on a single die, that's true, but when you get to the 8-core, they're not doing that 8 cores on a single die. It's two CPUs still, like the old PowerPC G5s were. And I think at that point, there's a separate bus going into each set of cores. So it seems like a bit of a compromise. And that might inform why at least Apple in their designs is still using SMP while other people aren't, is that they're maybe able to get a bit more memory performance to work around those limitations that you're talking about.
Now, what sort of multi-threading programming do you do in your daily life?
As little as possible.
Me too.
I had a coworker who once said, and I think this is actually not a bad way to. He said it, you know, kind of tongue in cheek, but if you unpack it a little bit, this is actually not a bad way to think about it. He said, if you're thinking about threads, if you're spawning a thread, you've done something wrong. You know, I mean, that runs up against, I think, what we're talking about, that it's going to get inescapable, that at some point, you know, there's going to be a tipping point where people have to know some way of getting at that concurrency. But right now, threading is, in my experience, very difficult to get right.
Yeah, it introduces an entirely new type of bug that I don't think a lot of people have experience with, sort of the race condition sort of bug that is very hard to debug. And I don't know.
Even an indirected deadlock can be difficult to suss out sometimes. How you get to that. But yeah, the race conditions are almost, they seem to defy determinism. you know, and I think that's what makes them so hard to pin down, is it's not like you can sit down, except in the most trivial cases, and kind of work through from first principles how you're going to get to. You know, it seems like you're reliant on much more sort of empiricism, that you're running iteration after iteration after iteration until a pattern starts to emerge, or you're leveraging some sort of intuition about, well, I think this is what these threads are getting in contention for. I think this is how this race condition's arriving. And I work, to get back to your question, I work with, Java. I know. There's a lot of critics of that. That's for my day job. That's what I do. And, I've been exposed more, I think, than the typical Java developer to the threading facilities in that language, which, you know, they vary. It's abstracted away. So on Linux, it may map directly to, pthreads, and on other systems, it may map to to lightweight processes or other ways of doing, that at the OS level. But that being said, even though it's a very high level language in that sense, even though there's some, there's especially with the later versions of the language and the platform, there's some really, really nice, work out of Oswego, that Doug Lee did to try to enhance some of the threading primitives to give us semaphores and cyclic barriers and some other ways to kind of get at concurrency other than, just threads and locks. So dealing with, atomic values, something that actually is very similar to what, Grand Central is doing with OS X technology that they've open sourced as, Live Dispatch, which is a way of just kind of queuing work into, threads that are more closely associated to the hardware in that instance. There are
oh, really?
Comparable facilities. Yeah, there's comparable facilities in Java for that, with the, 1.5 version of the development kit, the 5.0 version of the language and forward. There's something very, very similar to that. That makes it somewhat simpler, but you have to have this adjustment about how you're thinking. In that instance, you're not thinking about, I think it's more like the really big scale sort of parallelism that you get when you think about what Google's doing, with Doug Cutting's kind of replicated in Hadoop, the sort of map reduce, where you're just thinking about things as orthogonal tasks that you can fire into a queue, you can submit into a scheduler, and then you're doing some coordination on the other side of that. And that seems to alleviate some of those race conditions, but that still seems like a very awkward sort of idiom to get used to. You know, it's very different than what we're used to thinking of with even the simplest threading scenarios.
It's kind of, I don't know if you have any experience with the vector instructions, but there are a lot of vector instructions for like MMX, for instance, or these things, and I've come across two occasions where I had the pleasure of actually using them, if that makes sense. Like it's a very orthogonal in it's you have this data that gets processed symmetrically, and this data has no interaction with other bits of data. You have like four integers, for instance, that get multiplied, which is very nice if you're doing like multimedia sort of things. But in practice, I have pretty much practically have never used this. And it seems like to make use of the hardware, we have to change a lot of the methods that we use and the techniques that we use. Kind of at a more fundamental level than I think we realize. I think a lot of times people, want to develop a new language to fix things. And perhaps in the future there'll be this nice language that can do a lot of data flow analysis and figure out the perfect way to parallelize something. But until then.
Well, there's,
I'm sorry,
there's,
go ahead.
There's some there's some incremental steps along the way. I did a little bit of work with SIMD with, MMX, SSE2, SSE3, when I worked for an R&D startup that did some, video compression stuff.
Yeah.
And we were doing some pretty heavy lifting matrix math stuff that, at this point, you know, my math going into that wasn't very strong and was kind of stretched to the utmost. So I'm a little sketchy. That was years ago. But even then, we got, rather than kind of dig into how to make use of that, we looked into compilers that could do some of that optimization work for us that we would do a little bit, to concede to using those instructions. But you're right, SIMD is like, kind of one small step along the way. that's more like, you know, it's leveraging a single instruction across multiple registers. I mean, put in simplest terms, and if you can break it up, as you say, so that all of the inputs are kind of orthogonal, and you're doing something like matrix math. You know, you're processing arrays of data. That makes sense. But I found that to be true. It's kind of like, okay, now what else am I doing that actually fits into that model? And then we didn't even get into, I don't think we even had any hardware capable of doing MIMD, doing multiple instructions on multiple data.
I would say that,
even further.
Yeah, I would almost say that GPUs are, you can sort of consider this a MIMD type of architecture. I mean, granted, you have to set up a program and it's gets loaded into some hardware. And then gets run. It's not very clean, but you can have pretty much multiple data, multiple instructions. Mind you, the communication that is done between these programs is very, very little. It's a pixel value, say, and these things. But you're saying that we have not realized MIMD.
Well, that's a good example. I didn't think about that, and I think you're right. But it reinforces that, you know, outside of certain domains, you know, where are we seeing? I mean, I guess that there are projects that I've seen that I've written about that I've talked about where people are finding, and they're usually they are the kinds of things that can be sort of pipelined, like some researchers, some hackers that are working with GPUs to speed up crypto breaks.
Yeah.
But that also seems to be the kind of thing where you've got, you know, you're doing password recovery, you're trying to recover, you know, the inputs into, you know, factorization or some PKI, you know, something that drives PKI, something like that, or even a symmetric algorithm, where you're using that more for the ability to kind of, break off into smaller chunks and paralyze that then speed up the brute force, essentially. So it those both, I think, just kind of drive home that point that we don't have maybe, as you're saying, kind of just the mental tooling to say, how can I recharacterize more general problems to take advantage of that? And then I think you're right, that's sort of a piece when you get into multicore, which is just going to get worse. I mean, the GPU you could at least look at as well, you know, as long as we have GPUs that are driven more by gaming, then there's going to be a tighter marriage between what GPUs do and how they're programmed. And as a separate, very rich field, that's one thing. But I think you're onto something. You know, there's like Doug Patterson and the RANT project, I think, out of Berkeley, are looking at with FPGAs, they're simulating hundreds, if not thousands of cores and saying, okay, you know, what happens then? You know, what happens to programming then? You know, how do we actually build the tools? How do we even approach utilizing this in a way that's efficient and makes sense?
So they're simulating thousands of cores.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that each core is particularly fast because it's on programmable hardware.
Yeah.
But they're trying
for simulation purposes.
Yeah, exactly. But they're trying to address that question that you framed, which is, you know, how do we actually change how we think about programming so that we can get the most effect out of this? You know, how do we have to change compilers? How do we have to change programming languages? And I do think we're seeing a little bit of that trickling out. The biggest difference in Google's new language Go from some of the other languages out there is there seems to be that notion of concurrency kind of built in as a part of the language semantic. You have these concurrent blocks in it. And that seems to be a concession towards being able to, you know, rather than thinking in terms of threads and, okay, I've got to feed work to a thread and what's the thread life cycle and race conditions and obtaining locks or semaphores or, you know, all these other ways of coordinating threads, they're trying to, I guess, weave that more into the fabric of the language itself from day one, even more so than some of the other multi-thread capable languages that we've seen before.
How much experience do you have with Go? You said that you made reference to some sort of block mechanism. What is this block mechanism? I have no experience with Go whatsoever.
I just read through some of the documentation when it released just to kind of get to the bottom of what the hype was, because because everybody was like, ooh, it's a new programming language from Google. It must be awesome. And it's like, well, maybe. You know, they have this immense brain trust, you know, that Cerf and Brian Kurgan and Josh Block and so on and so on and so on. And this is one that's come from some of the computer scientists that they've employed over the years. And in looking at it, it's just as simple as it's a language symbol, which is concurrent. So it's a modifier on a functional block, basically. And so you're telling the compiler that's something that can be, parallelized. And I haven't read it close enough to know what constraints there are on that block in terms of input handling and return values and the like, but it seems to be a friend of mine sent me an article recently saying that the uptick on Go has been pretty good, that it's been solid, so the hype seems to at least been somewhat justified, that people are really kind of digging in. They've had a number of good releases over the past 3 or 4 months that it's been out. So I don't claim to have huge familiarity, but just doing some preliminary reading of the materials that they put out there. They put some good language documentation out there and put some good sample code out there. So if you're curious, it doesn't seem like it's too hard to dig in. And if you're comfortable in C, Go doesn't seem too much different from that. It's not of the complexity of you know, like the whole new raft of dynamic languages out there, Ruby and Python and so forth. It's not even, I would say, the complexity of like C++. It has interfaces, but it doesn't have the same kind of opportunity to go kind of hog wild with typing like C++. And you don't really have generics. I think it's as they put it, I think in the documentations, it's more of a systems language like C, so it's intentionally simpler. You know, so you can really do much lower level programming, and that, I guess, maybe that's why the concurrency aspects of it make sense. Is that if you're building, presumably from what I've read, Google's using this to program servers, highly concurrent, highly scalable servers on multi-core, multi-processor server hardware. And so having that available to make these, you know, highly scalable, highly concurrent, highly parallel servers makes a hell of a lot of sense. That, you know, maybe they were, their internal brain trust was just frustrated with trying to do that with pthreads, trying to do that with other things. Yeah, I know they use Python for a lot of higher level programming. I couldn't see them building, you know, the next Nginx or something like that in something like Python. So it seems like that was kind of their response to say, okay, we got to kind of go back to the drawing board and figure out how we can even build the systems, to build the applications to keep scaling and make sure that they're, you know, they're all about speed these days. So it makes sense.
Yeah, that's actually very exciting, the idea of an operating system of some sort being built upon a parallel aware language. It seems the operating systems we have are very much not parallel aware at all, and everyone is sort of clamoring to properly implement these things. So with the OpenBSD, for instance, by default, we don't even use hardware threads. We just have a user space thread kernel going. I mean, you can use kernel threads if you want to, but this is not what's going on by default. The code isn't there yet, and it's not as solid as everyone would like it to be. Everyone seems to be using locks primarily in the BSD world to synchronize parallelization. What do you think of architectures like the, what is it, the cell processor and these things?
That was a hell of an architecture. I used to know a hell of a lot more about it. I actually met again at that R&D firm. We were looking at cell processor with considerable interest, exactly for the reasons that IBM and their partners were kind of pushing it, that it had a better distribution of some of the capabilities, better memory coordination built into the single die. But it's been a while, so my recollection on some of the particulars are fuzzy. But it was, I was kind of disappointed to see that it really kind of didn't go anywhere. you know, outside of, there were a few notable applications, but it just didn't seem to get market traction. And I want to say that, yeah, some of that was just kind of the, you know, they did launch it with some programming tools, but just maybe not enough to make it as approachable. But it seemed in some ways, if memory serves, kind of more GPU-like in some regards, that you had ways to kind of do some of the coordination of data on the chip itself, which got us kind of excited in terms of, you know, you could at one point, you could be doing operations across a matrix of data, but then you could shuffle that data around fairly effectively. But I don't know that we ever got past kind of the proposal stage of talking to, we went up to the IBM campus in Armonk, New York, and we're in front of folks from Sony, Toshiba, and IBM. And there was kind of an interesting meeting of the minds, but we never actually got any hardware back into the lab at that point to really kind of pursue it. So it seemed to have a lot of promise, but it really also seemed to kind of, I guess put it simply, to bring the issues around parallelism really to a head, that, you know, this was not a chip that you could undertake lightly. You know, I mean, it was a very different animal. I mean, it's kind of interesting to see, you know, some of the other multi-core designs and how they differ, how they've taken a kind of a different route, not been as aggressive in, you know, I mean, it had, what, 8 or 9 cores on it back in the day, and we still haven't quite caught up with that. But it had some other interesting hardware built into the die. It wasn't just a multi-core processor, which is kind of interesting. There were some things that made the hairs on the back of my neck raise a little bit with that kind of touched upon trusted computing, that you could lock down individual cells and you could build a trusted pathway through the chip, that I found a little disturbing, to be perfectly honest, in terms of, you know, knowing who they were trying to pursue, the markets they were trying to pursue, and who they were positioning that to you know, try to say, by implication, we can close out the analog hole. You know, we can, you know, prevent people from really doing what they want to do. But, you know, I mean, that's like anything. It's, just because it's there doesn't mean that everybody used it. But, yeah, it was an impressive piece of hardware.
Let's see. I'm gonna begin to close this. I'm thinking of a good way to close it. Are you aware of there's this 1980s supercomputer that was massively paralyzed. It was a CMB5, I think, or something like that, by Thinking Machines, this company called Thinking Machines. Do you know anything of this?
Is that Danny Hillis's company?
I don't know. I have the image of the machine pretty clear in my head. It's this black sort of box that is separated into 4 boxes, and they have a lot of red lights all over the place. It's does that ring a bell at all?
That sounds vaguely familiar. When you say Thinking Machines, that sounds vaguely familiar. And yeah, that is, I think that, yeah, that's Danny Hillis's company. But I'm more familiar with, I think, Hillis's work in other areas. I think he was doing stuff with AI. He was doing some work at MIT. Applied Minds was, something he co-founded. So I'm not as familiar with the hardware you're talking about. I think I probably have read about it just in passing reference in some of my reading on machine intelligence. That sort of parallelism, that makes total sense for that application. You know, that's a suspicion a lot of these guys have had for a long time, is that our own wetware is massively parallel. So maybe if we build something that's parallel enough in silicon, then we can start to reach a similar sort of a cognitive computational model to what goes on inside of our brain.
Do you have any experience with any hardware languages? Verilog, for instance, or any of these things?
No, not firsthand. That again, the R&D firm I work for, we looked to, we were thinking about doing some implementation in silicon, but we were going to contract that out. So talking with some folks that did, I don't know if they did Verilog or some other design language, but in that space, that's what they were used to working for. It seemed like it made a lot of sense in terms of they could get very much further into the process and keep kind of the fabbing costs down by being able to prove stuff out with those sorts of languages. It seemed to be a lot more fruitful than just maybe before those languages were as developed. But I haven't done any myself. That's an area that I'm a little weak on.
There has been a little bit of effort to try and port C programs, for instance, into Verilog and these description languages. This essentially is doing the best job at figuring out what can be parallelized, because the hardware description language is everything running at once because it's hardware. So the platform of having a bunch of gates in this gate array seems promising because it's one where we can have any sort of parallelization that we can realize. We're not limited to figuring out how to run things on two cores and use their interconnect and how they access memory and these things. Do you have any thoughts on this idea at all?
Yeah, there are a couple of stories that I remember reading a few years back that kind of take that maybe to its logical conclusion or maybe at least to its next logical step where that makes sense to me, the idea of bringing kind of optimization theory to program the design language itself. That seems very appealing, but it seemed like there were some researchers working on hardware kind of in the same vein of an FPGA, but even more so, that could be reprogrammed on the fly in a similar fashion. But what's tickling my memory about that story is you saying, an FPGA is pretty laborious to program, but actually doing kind of a dynamic or metaprogramming. So you're programming the program that actually alters the gate array to do something different. And that was several years ago, though. I'd have to dig back into the website archives to dig that out. That seemed very, very promising for the reasons that you mentioned in terms of, rather than having to kind of have an engineer brain through what made the most sense in the silicon, actually having that sort of cooperation, building systems that could kind of augment and self-model and get to maybe designs that we would not have occurred to on our own.
Do you think there's a limit to how much we can parallelize? Will we see machines with thousands of processors, do you think?
I suspect that there probably is a limit, but I don't know that we've gotten anywhere near it as of yet. And I remain open to kind of a Kuhnian paradigm shift where we maybe find some other way. We've kind of dancing around that issue of is the limitation really the hardware or is the limitation in the engineer's mind in terms of how they design the hardware for parallelism, the programmer's mind in terms of how they take advantage of that. And I don't know. I think the jury's out on that. That's definitely one of the reasons why I find that question so fascinating. And I'm always on the lookout for stories that kind of touch upon that. As much as it turned out to be a little bit of a disappointment because there wasn't much meat to the story, but I think it was Dave Probertz at Microsoft.
Yeah.
Was kind of talking about, we need to rethink parallelism, and there wasn't a lot of meat to what he was saying. But it at least reminded us there are people out there who are thinking that we need to be doing more. We need to be pushing this frontier more. And I think that we're more on that end of things, of more just trying to figure out what the space looks like before we can effectively talk about limits. And then, not to open up another rabbit hole to disappear down into, but I think that there's also a lot of promise in quantum computers, which is an astonishingly different kind of parallelism, a very counterintuitive and odd sort of parallelism that the best research isn't even 100% sure that this is going to pay off in terms of having a huge amount amount of value beyond classical computing. But it's possible that, you know, like, so we've had clock speeds along with transistor density driving Moore's law. Now the clock speeds have kind of plateaued, and we're still driving the transistor density in terms of how many cores we're putting on a die. That's when Moore's law is still being served. Maybe at the point where the next kind of transition with that is, it'll be some other substrate, some other physical style of computing. So we're using spintronics, or we're using qubits and quantum registers and things of that nature, which are, in terms of programming those, that's even, I think that's even further out in terms of, you know, like there has been some research. Peter Shor, most notably, has had some good intuitions about what he thinks is going to work in terms of just an algorithm, let alone actual implementation. So I think the short version of that is, I think there's a long road. If there's a limit, I'm optimistic. I say it's a long way out, and there may be other things that allow us to extend that road even further out.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say that we haven't quite fully utilized the transistors that we have now. If that makes sense. It seems like we're encountering the same problems over and over again, and our implementations of them happen to consume more resources, and the problems that we're doing aren't really fundamentally changing in any way. And so that being said, a new programming paradigm, a new hardware paradigm, such as quantum computers, which, as you said, is very strange to program when you have sort of, ideally, it could be an infinite sort of parallelism, but practically, it's almost not programming, if that makes sense. yeah, it seems like I think we can make a lot more progress just in the realm of working on our algorithms and doing more with what we have. I mean, I see kids today a Commodore 64 today you can get for like $5 at the Goodwill, and think of the things that, perhaps you had a different computer, but think of the things that you've done with this Commodore 64 when you're in a teenager. This is nothing to the teenagers now. They could have a lot of sort of power for learning computers in their hands for very, very cheap, because the Commodore 64 is incredibly cheap. It's you can buy a burger for more than that, but that's being ignored, and it seems like I don't know. It seems like we haven't fully utilized what our hardware is now. Would you? Do you want me to expand on that, or would you agree or disagree with this, or what are your thoughts on that?
No, I definitely agree. I think that there's definitely a lot of waste in the systems we're using that we're not. I think you touched on something interesting there. So it's not just are we saturating the transistors available to us? Are we really tasking the hardware that we have, even the cheap hardware we have? But it seems like there might be, and I struggle with this as a parent, a cognitive waste of how do you really incent the generation that maybe is going to be the one that when they get into school or they're hacking on their own projects, following their passions, are the ones who are going to crack some of the challenges that we've talked about, who are going to find that new way of thinking, that new way of moving forward to really drive that parallelism to the point from the programmer's perspective where we are getting everything out of the silicon, and he knows what kind of crazy stuff's going to happen on the other side of that. I think that if I've been implying that there's any sort of nearer term limit, I don't think it's hardware. I think it's in our approach, absolutely. And the more we can do to kind of get more minds on that. So if that's coming up the equivalent of a thrift store, a $5 computer, or maybe something a little bit more modern, or that $5 computer just as a way to get somebody interested, who then goes on to, you know, 2-core, 4-core, 16-core box, and starts to noodle around in the way that we were noodling around, or the homebrew guys even back in the day were, you know, the MIT hackers before them were bumming instructions, and that the homebrew guys, you know, exemplified by Woz, were finding ways to do more with less and really push. So, you know, I would agree from that perspective to say maybe we need those kinds of challenges again. Maybe we need to find a way to get people interested in really pushing this hardware, this amazing hardware that we have, to that limit and see where it actually is. I think you're right. I don't think we're anywhere near it.
I think the embedded market, we have a lot of these embedded machines, and it seems like this has become more and more popular to have these smaller and smaller machines. And in the context that you had just described, I think that's very good. It seems like we have a possibility to figure out how to accomplish something in limited hardware, where we're not thinking that our hardware will be unlimited, if that makes sense. Typically, these embedded machines, it seems to me, run a lot of operating systems like Linux or things like these. But it seems to be like an emerging market that is beneficial to sort of restricted programming and maximizing algorithmic efficiency in these things. What do you think about that?
I think that might be that. You know, when you put it, when you suggest that actually makes me think about the maker movement and a lot of the cool, you know, microcontroller programming people are doing, or yeah, or SBC-based systems, whether it's robotics or multimedia applications, and maybe that might be the form that kind of programming takes. You're right. There's something to creativity with constraint that seems to have that weird sort of counterintuition. If you have you know, limited instruction cache, limited registers, you've got a stripped down Linux kernel, you've got some even less capable embedded operating system, that it really challenges you to get creative in your solutions. And then I guess the bridge on the other side of that, if you're looking at that as an avenue to kind of incite the next mind, you know, the people that are going to be looking at some of the problems we've been talking about, is just how do you scale that? Because in my experience, like, I work with a guy who is absolutely amazing at embedded programming. But he was crap. You put him on an actual desktop class system, and he was absolute crap. He couldn't make that transition. And then he would make really bad assumptions because he was so used to that limited environment. So I think there is an inherent risk too. So I think there's gotta be something in kind of the native talent of the embedded programmers that lets them kind of go beyond that. So maybe it's a diversity of projects. And making sure that they're not just down at the local hacker space playing around with these single board systems with Arduinos, but they're also doing something else, you know, on more capable systems, so they can kind of see those corollaries. If they can bring the experiences from each into the other, maybe kind of a renaissance programmer, if you will.
Well, thank you for coming on the line, command line. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So I guess I'll see you around, and I'll keep on listening to your podcast. It's very good. And you take care.
Thanks. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Hack Republic Radio. HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.